My name is Brent Lofgren. I work for the NOAA Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And we have a public relations officer, and she gave me a pile of brochures and stickers to pass out, and then I realized on the plane coming out here that I just forgot to pack all that stuff. So sorry I don't have that to give to you. Today I'm going to be talking about the job of the atmosphere. So in case you didn't realize that the atmosphere has a job, we're going to talk about what compels the atmosphere to have wind, clouds, storms, and all the other phenomena rather than just sitting there. And in the picture is the Mackinac Bridge, which connects the upper and lower peninsulas of Michigan. So that's pronounced with a silent C at the end, Mackinac. Goal for today is to set the stage for how the atmosphere works on a large scale. And if you're expecting climate change material today, there's almost none today. So we're going to sort of set the stage, talk about some of the basic characteristics of the atmosphere, and not get into climate change very much yet today. So all three sessions this week will emphasize building an understanding of the full system based on fundamental laws of science. And some of these topics have been contaminated by snap judgments and exaggeration or denialism, which kind of end up being flip sides of the same coin. But I will come down more critical of denialism than exaggeration. So this is what ends up driving the atmosphere. There's different amounts of sunlight that fall on different parts of the Earth, and that varies by season. So it's dependent in one location on both the number of hours of sunlight and the angle to the surface. How directly is it shining right on the surface? And that differs by location and season. So this creates the natural distribution of air temperatures in time and space, generally warmer near the equator with small amounts of temperature change by season, generally cooler at higher latitudes, but we have more seasonal change in temperatures at higher latitudes. And oceans and large lakes can absorb and store large amounts of heat and save them to release later. So that means that those surfaces are less prone to having large changes in temperature by season. They can carry that temperature over. So this is kind of a busy diagram, but it tells you the sources, exchanges, and fates of heat in the atmosphere. So you always need to think of light as heat. So this column right here is showing incoming solar radiation or sunlight. So that really is the ultimate source of heat in the atmosphere and the surface, land and ocean. That's the ultimate source of heat. Then there's also invisible light, infrared radiation, and that is the only way for heat to escape completely from the atmosphere. And then these are kind of bouncing heat back and forth in different ways. So the surface and the atmosphere are exchanging some of this infrared radiation, but it all has to eventually go out the top there. And then there are a couple of other mechanisms for exchanging heat from the surface into the immediately overlying atmosphere. We're going to set aside the latent heat idea until later in the talk. And then here, they're calling it thermals, or we also call it sensible heat. And this is the part that directly transfers temperature from the surface into the overlying air. So it can do that by conduction or just that first little bit of the atmosphere immediately overlying the surface. And then it really needs some other ways to get it even further up. And in the lower part of the atmosphere, the basic way of doing that is turbulence. So if you've got a very hot surface, it's going to have conduction by individual molecules to bring that up within just the first centimeter or so of the atmosphere. And then turbulence would be stirring of the air that would mix that up further. So turbulence really ends up mostly occurring within the bottom less than a mile of the atmosphere, but it can get up further. So that will mix the heat upward. Large-scale weather systems also tend to move heat upward. Thunderstorms are really discrete, concentrated areas of upward transfer of heat. Hurricanes are really organized systems of thunderstorms, so those are also transferring heat upward. We're going to talk a little bit later about the Hadley cell. So that's a permanent vertical flow that carries heat upward in the tropics. And we'll come back later and talk about water vapor transport, which kind of goes hand in hand with this. So if you're heating air differently in different places, it's going to end up with different density. So colder air is dense like a solid brick wall. Warmer air is less dense, like a wall with holes. And if you lean those two walls together, the solid one is going to push harder on the less dense one. So this can give you different amounts of air pressure at the same level in different areas. So you've got a cooler area, the layers of constant air pressure are closer together than in the warmer area, and that leads to a force. So the air is pushing right to left at the high levels, left to right at the low levels. Now, we need to combine this with the idea of the Coriolis effect. And the Coriolis effect is what happens when the platform that you're standing on is rotating. So if you imagine a merry-go-round like that, and you have people on opposite sides of the merry-go-round, it's rotating in the diagram here in a counterclockwise direction. I realized afterward the picture with the kids is clockwise. But so if this one is rotating counterclockwise and a person over here throws a ball straight across, while it's traveling, the person on the other side has moved over here. So this person is actually not just moving in a straight line, they're curving, and that makes the ball appear as if it's curving too. And that happens with the winds. They look like they're curving relative to a straight line, and what that appears like, it's an apparent force. So it looks like there's a force curving it. And that's an artifact of the rotation of that system. So the Earth is a spherical merry-go-round. At the poles, it's really straight up and down relative to the axis of rotation of the Earth. So this effect is strongest at the poles and zero at the equator. The Earth makes a full rotation each day. And it's in opposite directions in the northern and southern hemisphere. Now in the tropics, as I just said, there's a low Coriolis effect. So really these forces due to pressure of the air are able to just push things directly and they won't be diverted very much by the Coriolis effect. So we had the force going to the left at the top, to the right at the bottom, and then that circulation has to be closed by going down over here and up on the right. And this really ends up nearly equalizing the pressure horizontally, so it makes that pressure pretty much constant at any given height. And that is what leads to the Hadley cell. So that has rising air near the equator. The exact location of it changes by season, but near the equator, and then descending air at around 30 degrees, both in the northern and southern hemisphere. In the extratropics, you've got a stronger amount of Coriolis effect. So if you have a force pushing you to the right, that's the real force from the air pressure. You can balance that by having the appropriate amount of, the X means that there's a wind going into the page, so away from us here. And that is going to create a Coriolis force, an apparent force, to the right. And you can end up having those balanced in principle, but in actuality, the required wind ends up getting very high, and it starts to cause waves. It gets unstable. So actually going on to the next page. Two-bit word here, baroclinic instability. Bulges of warm and cold air develop due to baroclinic instability. So that's that wind trying to compensate for the pressure gradient, but getting so large that it's unstable. So too much work for the jet stream's Coriolis effect to hold back the pressure differences. So on this map, which is just an example, you end up having colder air in the western United States, warmer air extending further north in the east. And there are wind circulations associated with this. So you've got alternating winds in space from the south and north. So you've got warmer air flowing northward here right over the west coast, and southward flow right here. And actually you've got a strong gradient. It switches from southward to northward within a pretty small amount of space here, and then north to south over here. So these are bringing in air to these various regions that is kind of a contrasting temperature to what's naturally there. And what it ends up doing is it's mixing up those various temperatures that are occurring due to the effects of the sun, and it's reducing the contrast in temperature between the north and the south. I'll quickly go over what's happening in the polar regions. The gradients in temperature can be effectively countered by the Coriolis effect, generally in the polar regions, because the Coriolis effect is stronger there, for one, relative to the wind speed, and the temperature gradient is generally lower in the polar regions. And there's something kind of similar to the Hadley cell that occurs in the tropics. There's rising at the southern edge of it and sinking near the pole. Polar regions tend not to have as many storms as mid-latitude regions. just cold. Now, the other thing that is happening is transport of water vapor. So now we're going back to this idea of evapotranspiration and latent heat. So one of the ways that heat can be transferred from the surface into the atmosphere is by evaporation of water. So you can think of this as boiling a pot of water. You heat it up to the boiling point and it'll start boiling, vaporizing. And in order to continue to do that, you need to keep adding heat. If you turn off the heat, it'll stop boiling. So that is the heat that is required to turn that water into vapor and put it into the atmosphere. The same thing happens at somewhat lower temperatures in nature. Heat is consumed in order to evaporate water. So it'll be consumed at the point where it's evaporated and then transferred to another part of the atmosphere, and that's really on the next slide. So this the second bullet point, evaporating water consumes heat, can be transferred to another point, and then when it condenses, that heat will be released again into the air. So it kind of reappears at a different location. And general rule at the top, warmer air contains more water vapor. Actually, I'm trying to find better wording for these last couple of items here. Water vapor transport goes hand in hand with heat transport low in the atmosphere. So, as I said, generally warmer air contains more water vapor, so the warmer air is carrying heat simply by being warm and also by usually carrying more water vapor. In the tropics, water vapor transport actually goes opposite from overall heat transport, and that's because of equatorward flow at low levels. So what the tropics does is in the cooler areas, and I'm thinking especially of the ocean areas between about 10 and 30 degrees latitude in each hemisphere, of which there's a lot of ocean area there. This Hadley cell circulation can pick up a lot of water vapor from these oceans, carry it in toward the equator, and then when it when the air ascends, it will condense a lot of that water vapor out and release the latent heat right in that location. Now, in contrast to that, at the mid-latitudes, this is really just the same diagram that I showed before. Water vapor transport follows very closely with heat transport. And the water that rains out at higher latitudes often originates from lower latitudes. And one very classical thing that happens in the eastern United States, it's not quite happening in this case, but a lot of times you'll have transport of low-level air from the Gulf of Mexico right into the interior of the eastern half of the United States. In this case, it's really kind of turning around like that and not carrying much directly from the Gulf of Mexico, but nevertheless, this Louisiana-Arkansas area is a warm and moist area, and that can carry some moisture into those more northern locations. And again, it's a net northward transport of water vapor. So a couple of other quick points. Upward transfer, transfer of heat is most important in summer, and equator to pole transport is more important in winter. And that's a lot of that is just due to there being less of a difference in temperature between the tropics and higher latitudes during the summer. Oceans can also play an important role in transferring heat from the equator to the pole. One of the most familiar examples is probably the Gulf Stream. It's just carrying warm water and therefore heat from the tropical latitudes into the northern Atlantic Ocean. Contrast in temperature between land and water can cause some special situations. So sea and land breeze and lake effect precipitation can happen on relatively small spatial scales, and they also tend to be kind of more short time scales. They develop on time scales on the order of a day. And then another example of a phenomenon driven by land-water contrast is the monsoon on a larger scale. So various parts of the world have the monsoon, but the South Asian is the most familiar. And those monsoons really are accomplishing much the same thing as these very large-scale circulations. They're carrying heat and moisture from regions that have more of them to regions that have less. And this is just the quick piece of greenhouse effect climate change content for today. So where greenhouse gases fit into this picture, going back to this diagram of how all of the types of heat and where they're going between the surface and the atmosphere, greenhouse gases are really what control this downward part of the invisible infrared radiation. They control how much of this infrared radiation can get directly from the surface all the way out to space, but they're also controlling how much can get from various levels of the atmosphere out into space as well. So it's both natural and human-caused greenhouse gases make it more difficult for long-wave radiation to escape to space from the surface and lower atmosphere. So the natural part of that is basically good. It gives us the status quo type of climate. Human-caused greenhouse gases enhance that and are less likely to be beneficial. So the take-home points, the job of the atmosphere is to transport heat upward and poleward in the tropics. It accomplishes this by using very large-scale stationary circulation. It's not really circulation that moves around very much. In the extratropics, it is circulation that moves around. So it's waves or moving circulation patterns of about 1,000-mile size that that about is a very sloppy one. They can really be quite various sizes. So that that is my talk for today, and I welcome any questions.
Do you mind going back to the picture chart really quick and explaining? I'm just trying to remember.
This one?
Yeah, the numbers is like mm-hmm. the wavelength of on the, I guess, spectrum, and I'm not able to remember mm-hmm. you know, from infrared to ultraviolet, where, like, I'm assuming that those are different, you know, some of them are different kinds of light energy and...
Yeah, the numbers on here are really amounts of heat are being transferred, so it's in, they're all in units of watts per square meter.
Okay, I thought that was like the... Okay.
Yeah, and these numbers are really averages over the entire Earth. But one of the things that you can do is to add up the numbers and find that they end up being in balance at the surface, at least as illustrated here, okay? They end up being balanced at the surface, between the inputs and outputs at the surface, within the atmosphere, the inputs and outputs to the atmosphere are in balance, and the top of the atmosphere, the interface between the atmosphere and outer space, those are also in balance here. And part of the human-caused issue is that brings it out of balance. So we'll be talking about that a little more in the future.
Can you go back to the map of the U.S. with the high and low pressure? There.
Mm-hmm.
So right in the middle with sort of Missouri, Arkansas, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Is that why there that is considered Tornado Alley, because of what's happening there in the atmosphere with the warm and the cold air moving back and forth?
This is really just one snapshot from that I happened to grab from the internet, October 21st, 2006. So this is not a permanent feature.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just that day there happens to be a front that's located right here. Tornado Alley is due more to there being a tendency for some relatively dry areas and a lot of instability in the atmosphere. So that really leads to a lot of upward heat transport, which is accomplished by thunderstorms, which can spawn tornadoes. But yeah, tornadoes happen in Michigan. They happen in a whole lot of those northern Midwest states, as well as some of those more southern states.
So these arrows again, this is heat flow?
Actually, they are indicating both heat flow and moisture flow, essentially.
So what am I saying?
Or actually, in this case, the blue ones are indicating lack of moisture flow in the north to south direction.
But is this a common pattern, I guess, is what we're wondering? Or is it just a snapshot?
This one is representative. So I guess what I had in the text on the other version of this is that the exact pattern of this circulation keeps shifting, but it always results in a net northward transfer of heat.
Wow.
Yeah, especially during the winter. Just because the warm air is moving north, the cold air is moving south. That's a net northward transfer of heat.
Okay.
So when the heat is released, is it raining then?
Not always immediately, but in order for it to stay released in that location, the liquid water has to fall out. If it re-evaporates, that's swallowing up the heat and creating more latent heat that is associated with water vapor that can then be moved elsewhere and be released again. So my other sessions for later in the week, the next one will have to do with the history of ideas that led to the overall understanding today of of climate change, and some of them go back to the 1700s. We'll talk about how those were built up. And then on Friday, I'm going to be talking about myths associated with climate change and how some sort of, you can start with a true statement and imply some sort of connection to another statement and end up with some misleading information that goes to the final statement. Any more questions?
It just seems interesting to me that if the heat is going northward, that it's a lot warmer in the south.
Yeah, well, the point here is that difference would be even stronger without this mechanism.
It's moving now, but it's dumping the heat as it goes. So it's going to be warmer in the south, so it's going to drop. It's getting cooler as it moves. It's moving the heat in that direction, but it's getting cooler as it goes.
Yes, it is.
It's losing heat as it moves forward.
Yeah, right. Questions from up top?
No.
People up there.
Too basic. All right, I guess you're dismissed early.
Thank you.
Yeah.